Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife remastered episode, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. I've recently gone back and listened to some of the very first episodes, and I was reminded just how much valuable, relevant insight they still offer. So I'm excited to be re-releasing one episode each week, now with updated remastered audio for a much better listening experience.
In this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Penny Sartori about her book, The Transformative Power of Near-Death Experiences, that she co-authored with Kelly Walsh. Dr. Penny Sartori worked as a nurse for 21 years, 17 of those being in intensive care. She's conducted unique and extensive research into the near-death experiences of her patients, and in 2005, she was awarded a PhD for her research into near-death experiences. Dr. Sartori, thank you for coming onto the podcast. Now, just to start off, could you tell us about your first day as a student nurse and the patient that you encountered?
Yes, now that was really interesting because it was my first day on the ward, and I can remember I was sitting having the handover from the night nurse, and she just casually mentioned, oh, the man in bed 6, section C, he'll be dead by the end of the morning because he's been talking to his dead mother since 3 o'clock this morning. And I looked around and I thought, are they saying this now because it's my first day and they're trying to wind me up? But I looked around and all the other nurses carried on taking notes, you know, as if it was quite a normal thing. So I can remember feeling really curious about this. And so I went out to see that man. And indeed, I could see him gesturing to someone who I couldn't see. There was no one there, but he was clearly seeing someone. And he was having a conversation with whoever was there, you know. And I watched this for, you know, quite some time. And then I had to, I got called off for other nursing duties. So I kept coming back and forth throughout the course of the morning. And it was about 11:30 in the morning. And I can remember very vividly standing very close to his bed. And all of a sudden, it's as if he got some energy from somewhere. And he sat up. And he had his arms outstretched as if he was trying to reach someone or embrace someone. And he had a very big smile on his face and he looked very happy. And then he just closed his eyes and lay back down. And it looked like he'd gone off to sleep, but he died at that point. And that was the first time I ever really witnessed what's now known as a deathbed vision. And so I think that kind of got my curiosity from an early stage in my career.
And do you feel that that man that was having that deathbed vision got some real comfort from what he was experiencing?
I think so, because he seemed to be very, very peaceful, you know. And during my nursing career, I've been with thousands of patients as they've been dying. And sometimes, you know, it's not always that pleasant. Sometimes there's a little bit of distress or agitation, but this man, there was nothing distressful about that at all. You know, he seemed very comfortable. And, you know, he was just talking to someone who I couldn't see and gesturing and that smile on his face, you know. And that's something I've seen in many patients when they've been having these deathbed visions, is they do seem to be very peaceful and have that calm and peaceful transition into death. Whereas with patients who perhaps are not having such a vision, sometimes there can be a little bit of agitation in the way that they die as well. So it certainly seems that they're very comforted by whoever they are seeing.
And that's such a good thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, I wanted to talk to you about your book, The Transformative Power of Near-Death Experiences, How the Messages of NDEs Positively Impact the World, that you wrote with Kelly Walsh.
Yes, that's right.
This is a book about near-death experiences and the effect they have on people's lives. Can you tell us how the idea for this came about?
Well, it was a few years ago, and it was in 2014 when I first met Kelly. Introduced via email, really. And my book, The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences, had been released, and that had been serialized in a national newspaper, and it had got a lot of attention and it had gone viral. And so I started to receive thousands of emails. And at the time, I was quite heavily pregnant, and it was May time, and my son was due to be born very soon. And I was getting, it was a full-time job responding to these emails. And so at that point, I thought, right, I need to focus on the birth now, and I need to take some time out. So I decided not to respond to the emails until after the birth. And as soon as I made that decision, this email just landed into my inbox, and it was very short, and it was from Kelly Walsh, and she just said, the exact wording is in the book, and she says, hang on, I've got it in front of me, let's see if I can find it, because it was just very, very brief, but I think because it was so brief, it really got my attention, and intuitively, I just knew that I should contact her. So this is what it said. It just said, "Hi Penny, I had an NDE in 2009, and my life's work and the vision I am working towards is connected to my experience. I'm based in Manchester in the UK, and I'm keen to speak to you about my NDE. Would it be possible to arrange a Skype call?" And there was something about that that made me kind of intuitively just get in touch with Kelly immediately, which I did, and we did have a Skype chat the next day, and I was really impressed by what Kelly said, because she described that she had been at the lowest point in her life ever, and this after years and years of anxiety and depression and lots of other things, she decided that she just couldn't go on with her life. And she tried to end her life by taking a massive overdose of paracetamol. And she didn't seek help for 3 days. And when she went into hospital, there was not anything, like they couldn't pump her stomach because it was too late. And so she went to the psychiatric ward. And it was later in that day when she was dropping off to sleep in the night, she was lying in bed and she started to have this amazing experience where she felt that she'd traveled through 7 bumps of the universe, and she just seemed to be traveling at high speed. And she said it was almost like it was a bit of a struggle for her to get past each bump. And as soon as she was past the 7th bump, she was just enveloped in this totally unconditional, peaceful love that she can't even describe. She can't put it into words. And then she remembers kind of waking up on the ward, and she's not sure how long this experience lasted because time just didn't seem to have any meaning. And apparently that when she woke up, she then started telling everyone around her that she'd been speaking to God and that like-minded souls would collaborate to change the world. And her experience has actually given her sort of the motivation to turn her life around completely. And during the following years, what she's done then is created a cartoon character called Positivity Princess. And she's branded this, and she's got a very good business mind. But she could make, you know, that what impresses me about Kelly is that she wants to do good in the world. And she, from her ideas and what she's done already, she could make millions and millions of pounds, but she's not concerned about making money for herself. She wants to, what she calls, create profit for a purpose. And so what she's done is set up a charity, a children's charity, and she plans to help charities all around the world and empower young children as well. So this cartoon character, Positivity Princess, is all about teaching young children from a young age to be empowered. And I just think her message is amazing. And, you know, the thing that's driven her to do this is her actual near-death experience that she had when she was in hospital. So, you know, what I find fascinating as well is that prior to her experience, she'd undergone lifelong anxiety and depression. But there's something about these experiences that really do have that transformative effect, because now Kelly's anxiety and depression has completely gone and it's been turned around. And, you know, I don't know of any pharmaceutical drug that has such ability as well, you know. So I think these experiences are so fascinating because they empower people so much and they can change their lives in such a positive way. And this is why then we decided to write this book, because I've come across so many other people who have also experienced great transformations as a result of their experience. And the thing is about these experiences is that these people who feature in the book, these are ordinary people who have had extraordinary experiences. And it's these experiences that have changed their lives and have guided their life afterwards. But another thing as well to add about these experiences is that then initially they can be very overwhelming and people don't understand them. So it's extremely important that people are supported so that they can understand the experience and they can begin to process it and they can integrate it into their life, because it does come with a lot of life changes as well. So, for example, some people find that they no longer have anything in common with their spouse anymore. And in fact, after a near-death experience, there is some research to show that there's quite a lot of divorce after an experience as well, simply because, you know, the people find that their values change drastically and they no longer have those things in common with their loved ones. Another thing is that sometimes they feel motivated to change their jobs because the job that they're in is no longer aligned to what they feel is their life purpose. So there's a lot of changes that come with these experiences, and sometimes it can take years and years for someone to really get to terms with understanding what it is that's happened to them. So, you know, I think it's crucial that we have more awareness of these experiences. And, you know, sometimes people who don't understand what this experience is, sometimes they can be dismissive about it and kind of brush it off and say, oh, you know, you had too many drugs when you were in the hospital or something like that. And, you know, comments like that, as well-meaning as they're trying to be, they can be very unhelpful to the person as well. And sometimes if someone has kind of plucked up the courage to talk about the experience, and if it's then dismissed offhandedly, that person will tend to not talk about the experience again, you know. So it's so important that people are aware of what these experiences are.
And do you think that medical staff who encounter dying patients as part of their job should have training on NDEs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's something that I feel very passionately about, because, you know, the nursing staff, the doctors and the nurses, they are there when these people are waking up and recovering from a critical illness or a cardiac arrest. And, you know, very often, I think the people who've had these experiences don't understand them at the time. And it can be a very overwhelming and daunting experience. Now, I think if nurses and doctors were trained to actively look for these experiences or talk about them and say, look, when you're unconscious, you might have had some unusual experience. And just explain to them, you know, that this is a common experience. Lots of people do have these experiences. And then they can guide them then to further resources if someone has had this experience. So I think it's crucial that healthcare workers are able to identify a near-death experience. But also the most important thing is that they validate it for the patient so that they say, it's okay, other people have reported these experiences. It's something that does occur quite commonly. And that's all, you know, even if they just said something as simple as that, that in itself can be such a great help.
Now, some of the near-death experiences that people report are not always that happy, are they?
No.
I was reading the one, is it Gigi Strehler?
Yeah.
She said she was alone in a void, which could have been quite distressing.
That's right.
But actually, she said it was quite peaceful.
Yes, that's right. Now, there are, there can be distressing kind of near-death experiences, and these are much harder to research because a lot of people don't want to talk about these for various different reasons. first, some people think, oh my goodness, you know, what's wrong with me? Other people have described some really pleasant experiences, but mine was really horrible. And so they'd be afraid to talk about it for that reason. Some people think, oh my goodness, I've had this awful experience. I must be a bad person. And there's absolutely no evidence to support that at all. And then some people are so terrified by what has happened to them that they really are afraid to even think about what they've experienced as well, because sometimes just recalling the experience can be quite traumatic for them. So the type of distress in near-death experiences that we know of, there's been three different categories, and these were categorized by Professor Bruce Grayson and Nancy Evans-Bush. And they did some research on this quite some time ago. And what they found was that there's the first type is the usual type of near-death experience, but it's interpreted in a very unpleasant and distressing way. So they see the usual kinds of symbols or the tunnel or the light, but sometimes they can interpret it in a distressing way. The second type then is the void experience, where someone might find themselves in this dark, black, and meaningless eternal void. One lady has even described this to me as eternal boredom. And then there's a third type of experience. And third type is more of a hellish type of experience. So some people feel that they're actually looking into hell, or that they're being dragged down by demons into hell. And this is so traumatic for the people that just recalling the experience can cause them great problems. And I know trying to communicate with people who've had this kind of experience is very difficult, because sometimes I get emails sent to me and some people will say things like, can you help me? I've had this distressing kind of experience. I need help. But it takes them a long time to disclose anything about the experience, and sometimes they can't even disclose it, and so they're just asking for help, but it's really difficult to know how to help them because I don't know exactly what they've been through as well. So it can really, really be traumatic for people, and I think it is so important that we do recognize these experiences so that, again, we can support people who have this distress in kind. Because there are some cases in the literature where they have been very distressing, but then they've changed into a pleasant experience as well. Now, we don't know why some people do have these distressing kind of experiences, because it doesn't seem to be anything to do with their moral character at all, because even the nicest of people can have the distressing kind. It has been suggested it might be to do with people who are used to being very much in control of their life. And so they're faced with this situation, and it's almost like it's the ego, it's fighting the experience. So it's failure of the ego to relinquish the ego so that they can relax into the experience. Because it seems that when people stop sort of fighting or resisting the experience, it can at that point turn into something pleasant. So there's certainly both kinds of experiences do occur.
In the conversation I had with Nancy Rhines, she said the environment she found herself in during her NDE was constructed specifically for her, to give her what she needed so the experience was most beneficial for her. Do you think that perhaps this could be the case for everyone that has an NDE?
It could be, and how they then process it afterwards is crucial then to how they understand it as well. So, you know, it could be that, yes, certain things, and then on reflection, people can look back at the experience and think, oh gosh, that makes sense to me now. So that's why it's really important that they get support when they're reflecting on the experience. But again, for the people who have these really, really distressing kinds, it's almost like a form of post-traumatic stress. So just going back to that experience and just kind of reflecting on it in itself can be traumatic. So I think there's certainly a lot more research that needs to be done into these experiences, but it's difficult to find people who are able to talk about the experience in depth as well.
And there are people who go through a cardiac arrest and are revived, and they don't experience any kind of NDE. Could it be that some people do not experience an NDE because, from a spiritual point of view, they don't need one? They didn't need that life-changing experience.
It could well be. That's an interesting point. It might be that, you know, some people have them because it's something that perhaps they've needed in this, on a spiritual level. Another thing that makes me think, though, is it that people who have a cardiac arrest, perhaps everyone does have a near-death experience, but not everyone recalls it. And the reason I say this is because I've gathered a few cases where at the time of a critical incident where someone has lost consciousness and then revived, they have absolutely no recall of any kind of experience. But a few months or maybe years later, there might be a situation arises and they can recall a near-death experience that happened at that point when they were unconscious. Now, I can give you two examples of this. There was one lady who was severely attacked in her home, and she was left for dead by the attacker. And she remembers receiving all of these punches, and she then found herself, she remembers being hit and falling to the floor, and then she lost consciousness, and she doesn't remember any near-death experience. Now, during that attack, her nose was broken and she had to go into hospital a few months later to have surgery to correct her nose. And when she went under anaesthetic, she was suddenly back and re-experiencing that attack, only this time when she lost consciousness and hit the ground. Instead of everything going black and not having any recollection, she then recalled having a near-death experience at that point. So that was really quite interesting to me, because it raises that question. Does everyone have a near-death experience, but they simply don't recall it? And there's another case that I can tell you about, and that's Ainsley Threadgold, who features in the book The Transformative Power of Near-Death Experiences. When he was a child, he was knocked over and he broke his leg. And he remembers kind of being hit by the car, and that's it, he lost consciousness. And it was many years later, and synchronistically, he had problems with his leg again, and he'd gone to see an osteopath. And he started talking about the osteopath, and he said, you know, this is the leg I broke when I was run over. And the osteopath, this is really quite incredible, had actually read my book, and he'd had a near-death experience. And so he started asking Ainsley questions, and he said, do you think you could have had a near-death experience and just don't remember it? And so, interestingly then, Ainsley sought out a therapist, and she did some hypnotic regression on him, and she took him back to the time when he was knocked over. And at that point, when he lost consciousness, he then remembers going into the ambulance. And he was accompanied by another person who he calls the carpenter. And so he had a near-death experience as well, but didn't recall it until he had that regression therapy. So again, that is very interesting. But I did read somewhere as well that to be very cautious about having any hypnotic therapy around near-death experiences specifically, because it can kind of take the person back to the actual physiological symptoms as well. And I think there was a case of someone who had a near-death experience when he was in heart failure, and when he went through some therapy, regression therapy, he started to manifest the symptoms that he was going through at the time. So, you know, there's a lot of caution to be had there as well. So, but it's fascinating, you know, is it the case that, you know, everyone has these experiences but simply doesn't have the recollection of them?
There are also some after effects that people experience, including heightened intuition and synchronicities and having an effect on electronics. What do you make of this?
Yeah, that is really fascinating to me. There's all sorts of after effects, you know, and One thing that I'm interested in is the changes in someone's electromagnetic field. So, you know, they find that they can't wear wristwatches, and they could be the wind-up wristwatches, or they could be digital. And, you know, they could be really expensive watches, and they'll work for other people, but they won't work for the person who's had the near-death experience. And I know a friend of mine who, a former nurse colleague, she had a near-death experience many years ago, and she has that same problem. She's never been able to wear watches, whether they're expensive ones or not. They just stop working for her. And also, you know, with that electrical activity as well. So, you know, light bulbs will blow in their presence, and microphones might fail. It can be really expensive because a lot of computers can crash as well. And things like, you know, credit card machines. People find that they can't use the credit card machines afterwards as well because they'll stop working for them for some reason. So, you know, it comes with all sorts of things as well, the near-death experience. And again, you know, with regards to intuition, people feel that their kind of intuition really does develop and becomes very, very heightened, some even to the point where they can almost read people's minds. And sometimes that can be really disconcerting for them as well. And I know another former colleague of mine, she had a near-death experience in childhood. And since that time, she has that ability to tune into people's thoughts. And she doesn't like it because she feels like she's invading people's privacy. And sometimes she will keep her distance from people because she can see things that are going to happen in their future as well, and she doesn't like to talk about it. So, you know, it can come with the unpleasant after effects as well.
Now, there is a chapter in your book by a man called Tibor where he does some traveling, and he describes some man's socks. This was some form of verification that he actually did see that person's apartment.
Yes. Oh, this is fascinating because he's a Hungarian man. And he was in intensive care, and he had a cardiac arrest, and he left his body, and he was aware of doctors and nurses, you know, paying a lot of attention to this patient, and he didn't realize it was him until he kind of had a close look. But his attention was taken to various different parts of the hospital, and so he found himself drifting into another room. And in that room, he was observing the nurse drawing up some intravenous medication, and she dropped the syringe on the floor and it went underneath the table, and he could see where it landed. And then he went into another room, and he was observing one of the nurses on the phone to her husband. And her husband was frantically asking her where the address book was, their address book, because he was looking for the number for a pediatrician because their child had a fever and he was going to call the doctor to come and have a look at him. And as soon as Tibor connected into this conversation, he found himself in the apartment witnessing the man. And, you know, this Tibor was in cardiac arrest at this point, so his brain was not functioning. His brain wasn't functioning. So, you know, how was his consciousness able to travel to another place? But basically, he was in a heightened state of awareness, and he had the presence of mind where he was able to deduce from what he saw in the apartment. He could see the man's books on the bookshelf, and he was able to deduce that this man was an engineer. He described the apartment. He described a rug in the apartment. And he also described that this man was wearing rather eccentric type of socks, and he described them. And then when another part of this experience as well is he also went to the floor above where Tibor's bed was, and he was able to see the patients in the surgical intensive care unit, and he also knew their diagnoses as well. And when he revived, the doctor was very interested and asked him if he remembered anything. And indeed, Tibor told him everything that he'd seen. And this doctor took the time to check out the diagnoses of the patients in the surgical intensive care unit above. And indeed, he found that Tibor was correct about these diagnoses. And then the doctor was so intrigued that he actually travelled to this nurse's apartment with her. And he met her husband, and he could see that the apartment was as Thibaut had described it. And he actually came back to the hospital with the socks in his hands as well. So, you know, that is something that really fascinates me, because there was that bit of authentication of it by the doctor who had been out to the apartment as well. So, you know, this is quite fascinating, because what we're seeing is patients who should have no conscious experience at all because they're in cardiac arrest, yet they are describing a heightened state of awareness. So, you know, that's something that we don't quite understand, and it doesn't fit in with this materialist perspective that the brain produces consciousness. So I think what we're seeing with these near-death experiences is that we have to revise the way that we understand consciousness. And it may not be that the brain produces consciousness, but it would make more sense to see the brain as mediating consciousness.
I saw a documentary recently that portrayed the absolute scientific certainty that consciousness came entirely from the brain. Why do you think it is, after so many decades of research into NDEs, that the scientific community is determined to ignore the evidence?
I think it's that they're comfortable with what they know. And, you know, if you look at the work of Professor David Chalmers, you know, he says there's no way to describe how consciousness arises from the brain. There may be neurological correlates that occur as we're having certain conscious experiences, but there's no hard evidence to show how consciousness arises from the brain. And as Professor David Chalmers calls this, it's the hard problem of consciousness. And, you know, I think we have a lot more work to do. We still don't understand consciousness, and it's cases like Thibaut's and other cases that have been revealed in hospital research that is kind of showing that that perspective to be incorrect.
Is it correct that if patients are heavily drugged, then they're less likely to have an NDE?
Yeah, that's what I found with my hospital research, actually. When I did my hospital research and I analysed the data, I found that the patients who had been given medication that we kind of, medication has been suggested as being the cause of an experience, but I actually found the opposite. When I analysed the data, the people who had been given large amounts of these painkilling drugs or sedative drugs, they were actually less likely to have an experience. And if they had, you know, some people had the beginnings of what could have been a near-death experience, but it seems that it was turned into a confusional experience when medication had been administered. So, you know, rather than the belief that these drugs create an experience, what I found is that they, if anything, inhibit the experience.
And do you find that people who attempt suicide because they're in a very dark place in their life, that after they've had an NDE, it really lifts them out of that?
Yes, it certainly can do. It can have that really, it can give them a totally different perspective on life. And they can be in that really dark, dark place. And then they can have this experience and it can just turn everything around for them. And they realize, you know, that one of the things that Kelly said, you know, after her experience, she realized that she believes we don't die. And so our problems go with us wherever we are. So even if we try to end our physical life, those problems will still be there until we face them and confront them. And certainly that's what a lot of people who have these experiences during a suicide attempt, it can turn their life around for them. Absolutely. And in fact, as well, in America, there's some therapists who have used accounts of near-death experiences for patients who are suicidal. And if they're able to read about people's experiences when they've tried to, or any kind of near-death experience, it starts to give them a different perspective on life as well. And so, you know, the benefits of understanding near-death experiences can be really far-reaching, I think, and it could really do a lot in suicide prevention as well.
All of the experiences that I've read in your book, they're all quite different and they're all quite personal to the person, but they're all really transformative experiences. Mm-hmm. As you were saying, the suicide patients read up on it and it's quite therapeutic.
Yes.
I wonder if it could be more widely used.
Yeah, and I think that's something that certainly could happen. And I know it is being used in with private therapists, and so it is something that's becoming more and more prevalent. So it would be good to see more people using it. And I know there was quite a lot of work done a good few years ago now in America, and it seems to have had a really positive effect on people's lives.
I believe you were on the spot when a patient had an NDE. Is it patient 10 that you refer to him as?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that was during my hospital research. This is a very interesting case because of what happened, really. I'd been looking after this man, and we decided to sit him into the chair. He'd been in intensive care for a few weeks at that point. He was making a good recovery. He was still ventilated, and he had a tracheostomy. So we'd sat him in the chair this day, and I can remember as soon as we sat him in the chair, his breathing pattern changed a little bit and his oxygen levels went down. And I connected what we call an ambu bag to his tracheostomy, connected it to the oxygen point. And I gave him some extra breaths of oxygen, and that resolved his oxygen saturations level. They came back up to normal. But it was a few minutes later and his blood pressure started to drop and his heart rate went into a very fast rhythm, very, very briefly. And he started to get grey and clammy. And all of these were signs that he could go into cardiac arrest. So we literally flung this man back into bed. And within minutes, he was deeply, deeply unconscious. So my colleagues had called the doctor. The doctor came and he was busy at another emergency, but came and reviewed him. We gave him some fluid to bring his blood pressure back up. And then again, his blood pressure started to drop, but that doctor had gone back to the emergency. So my colleagues kept an eye on my patient and I went off to look for another doctor. And as it happened, the consultant walked onto the unit for the first time that day. So he very quickly came and reviewed my patient for me. He shone a pupil torch in his eyes and he prescribed some more fluid, which resolved his blood pressure. And after he'd examined him, the patient then started to flicker his eyelids and he started to move all four limbs. And this is signs of regaining neurological functioning. So the doctor was happy that the man was recovering and he was stable. So he went off to his office. Now, it was about 4 hours later and this patient was, the ward round was approaching his bed. So there were several doctors there, nurses, there were physiotherapists, the dietitian and the pharmacist. So they were all there and this man was very excited about something. He couldn't talk because of the tracheostomy, but he was trying to communicate something. And the physiotherapist got him a letter board and he spelled, "I died and I watched it all from above." And so the doctor said, "Oh, you'd better tell Penny about that then. She's very interested in this." And the doctor documented it actually in his notes that he'd revived and reported this experience. And the patient described that he'd left his body and he was looking down from above. And he described everything that the nurse did. And the nurse had cleaned his mouth and because he dribbled out of the side of his mouth. He described the doctor and he correctly identified which doctor had examined him and shone the pupil torch in his eyes. And he hadn't seen that doctor that morning prior to losing consciousness. And he also described the physiotherapist looking very nervous and poking her head around the curtains. And this is exactly what happened. And I know because I was there, I was the nurse who had cleaned his mouth. And he described my actions very accurately. And while all of this was going on, this was when the man was most deeply unconscious and his eyes were closed. And he was not responding to deep, painful stimuli. So further to this, he also described looking upwards and going into a pink room where he met his deceased father and his dead mother-in-law, who he'd never met but recognised from photos. And also in the middle of them, there was a man. And he said, "I'm not sure who this man was, but I think it could be Jesus. But it's not what I expect Jesus to look like, because he had long, scruffy hair that needed to be combed." And he said he also had these really bright, piercing eyes as well. And he was very drawn to look at his eyes. And he said when he was in this state, he was so peaceful, so comfortable, all his pain had disappeared, and he wanted to stay there. But the Jesus figure said, "No, it's not your time. You have to go back." And he then started to see, it's almost as if he was sucked backwards into his body, and the image faded in front of his eyes. And he said he was back in his body, and as soon as he entered into his body, he was in immediate pain. And that pain was so bad that he wished that he'd actually died. Now, another interesting aspect of this case is that when I did a follow-up in-depth interview with this man, he misinterpreted one of my questions. And my question was, when you were out of your body, is there anything that you can do that you can't do normally? Now, I was getting at sometimes if people think of a location, they can instantly find themselves at that location. But he misinterpreted that, and he held up his right hand and he said, "Oh yeah, look at this. I can open out my hand. I've never been able to do that before." Now, this man has cerebral palsy, and he was 60 years of age at the time of his experience. And his hand had always been in a permanently contracted position, very much like a claw. And after his experience, he can now open it out fully. And I didn't realize the significance of this until I discussed it with the physiotherapists and the doctors, because they said that physiologically, that should not be possible unless he'd had an operation to release the tendons, because his tendons would be in a permanently contracted position. But no such surgery was performed. And I checked his notes. I checked his physiotherapy notes to see if he'd had extensive hand physio, but nothing like that was done. And his sister has actually signed a statement to say that he'd never been able to open out his hand prior to that experience. So he attributes it to the near-death experience. And to me, that is really fascinating. I'm fascinated by it because there are probably millions of people in the world out there with similar ailments. And if we understood the mechanism behind this, how many people would benefit from that without having to have surgery? So, you know, I think we should be really intrigued by these experiences because we can learn so much from them.
And it's a pity this information isn't more widely known.
Exactly. That's right. I know. And that's it. You know, people don't really kind of pay that much attention to it at all. And that baffles me. It really does.
In the book, some of the people say that they gained an immense amount of knowledge. Do they ever come back with that knowledge? As they say, they lose it when they wake up.
Some people do, yes. But I can think of one case in particular. She's not in this book, actually, but her name is Raja Benamor. And I met her at a conference I spoke at in Marseille in France in 2013. Now, this lady fascinates me. When I met her, she had on dark glasses because she had light sensitivity after her near-death experience. And what happened to her is she had some sort of reaction to anaesthetic. I'm not sure if it was an anaphylactic shock, but she'd gone into hospital for some routine surgery. And as soon as the anaesthetic was administered, she all of a sudden had this amazing experience where she had a life review that took her back not only to her birth, but it went back further and it went back to the birth of the whole universe. She also felt that she shrunk down into a quantum size and she traveled around the inside of her body. And the fascinating thing for me is that she seemed to have this knowledge of quantum physics. And when she kind of recovered and she went home, she was so kind of motivated as a result of her experience and this knowledge that she seemed to have gained, that she actually went to university then to study quantum physics. And the interesting thing in this conference that I attended was that they'd actually interviewed her university professor. And he said that the knowledge and insight that she's got is phenomenal. And he said it's really deep-seated knowledge. It's not something that you could just gain through reading a few books or doing some sort of booster course in quantum physics. This is really deep, deep-seated knowledge. And he said that in some of her assignments, the things that she'd been writing about, not even he fully understood them, but what she had written about had then later been verified in new publications that had been published in physics journals by other authors. So, you know, he said he doesn't understand how she could have gained this information. So I think Raja Benamor is someone who is, you know, has come back and actually retained that knowledge as well.
And this is a great indication that there really is something to NDEs. Some people say they're just hallucinations, but this shows there is more to it.
Oh, definitely. You know, and I remember back in the 1980s, Kenneth Ring's book, Heading Towards Omega and the Omega Project, you know, and he talks about cases of people who had this kind of incredible knowledge and this mathematical equations knowledge that they'd never had before. And I remember him talking about one lady who was able to fix the whole telephone network in the building in which she worked, because she kind of intuitively knew what to do. It's incredible, you know, how people can have this knowledge after a near-death experience.
There are cases where there are people who are religious and have a near-death experience, and they might report that they meet Jesus. But then there are atheists who have near-death experiences who don't say that. Do you feel that this person's own beliefs and consciousness affect their near-death experience?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we all grow up and we all kind of are bombarded by these different symbolic images around us. And, you know, so I think it certainly is kind of influenced by our upbringing. And, you know, some people as well, culturally as well, you know, so in different cultures, they see different symbols as well. So it's almost as if, you know, Carl Jung talks about the archetypes and the collective unconscious. So the collective unconscious of the whole of humankind. And it's almost like during a near-death experience, people are tapping into that collective unconscious and then interpreting it via the symbols that they are most familiar with in their life as well. So, you know, as you said, you know, some people might see Jesus or Mary if they're from the West. Whereas if they're from India, for example, they might see Yama, the god of the dead, or Yamadutes, the messengers of the god of the dead, or they might see Chitragupta, the man with the book, and that's the book of deeds of their life. And this book of deeds kind of lists everything that they've done in their life. And, you know, that can be compared with the Western version of someone having a life review where they relive the whole of their life. So I think what we're seeing is similar things, but they're interpreted according to the cultural filter of each person as well.
When they go through the life review, there seems to be some entity with them that is guiding them through it. But that entity is not judgmental at all.
Yes.
And it is the person themselves that is judging their actions.
Yeah, and that really interests me a lot, because what some people say is that they're watching this and some parts of their life review are really painful for them to watch, and it's really difficult, and they have great shame when they're faced with that. And in some cases, the being of light that's with them as they're watching their life review has actually fast-forwarded some of it to make that life review a little bit easier for them as well. And almost as well, sometimes when they're reliving parts of their life review, that being of light is there as a great source of comfort. And there's absolutely no judgment from that being of light. It's, as you said, the person themselves who is making the judgment.
And do you have any figures of how many NDEs people experience every year? or even every month?
Well, I guess that's going to be rising, really, because I think, you know, with our advances in medical technology now, it's funny because our science is amazing and then we've got all this breakthrough medical advances and things like that. So what we're seeing is more and more people are now surviving critical illness and more people are surviving cardiac arrest. So I think you're going to see more and more people experiencing near-death experiences as well. But out of the research, you know, it's between about 11 and 20% of people who are successfully resuscitated do report a near-death experience. So then if you think about how many people are resuscitated every year, if you think between 10 and 20% of those, that's quite a lot of people, you know, and we're seeing a lot more people having these experiences now. And I think because attitudes are changing such a lot to these experiences, you know, when I started my research, and this was back in 1994, people were very skeptical, extremely skeptical, and they were very dismissive of near-death experiences and really didn't want to hear much about them at all. But then over the years, what I've seen is that those attitudes are changing. And certainly I was lucky enough to work with a great team of nurses and doctors in the intensive therapy unit in Morrison Hospital in Swansea. And they became very intrigued by my research. And in fact, the doctors paid a lot of attention to it at the end, especially when I was coming to the end of my results. And I can remember some of the consultants saying to the junior doctors to have a chat with me about my research as well. And I think what we're seeing now is because attitudes are changing so greatly, you know, this is now over 20 years later, more and more people are willing to talk about the experience and they're willing to try to understand the experience. And I think more people are willing to share their experience. So the more that people share their experiences, the more other people are going to be educated about them as well. So I think, you know, we're going to see great changes again in the future because this is going to be quite a normal thing to talk about in the future.
And can I ask you, how has studying NDEs affected you?
Oh, it's absolutely changed my life for the better. And I think, you know, studying them has just given me that completely different perspective. And I think if I hadn't been working as a nurse, I'm not sure I'd have been as kind of convinced about these experiences as well. It's because I've been actually been there and when they've been happening as well. And it just gives you a completely different perspective because, you know, I've nursed thousands of patients who have been critically ill. And then people who have this near-death experience, there's something different about them, you know. You know, and people are unconscious. They come to and they're very vague and disorientated. But then the people who've had the near-death experience, they talk with great clarity of thought. They're very precise about what they've experienced. And I think actually being there when people have had the experiences has given me that different perspective. But I think engaging with the near-death experience as well has made me realize that these experiences have very important messages for us. And I think we can all benefit from these messages without coming close to death ourselves. So what I found is that my life has been very much empowered. And, you know, when I started doing my research, people used to tell me I was morbid. But I think when you start to learn about death, you really start to learn about life. And it's certainly made me confront my own mortality. And it's made me have appreciation for the things that I have in my life. Instead of striving for things I don't have, it's really made me appreciate all the wonderful things that I do have in my life and what a gift life is. And it's just, you know, doing my research has made me extremely happy. And if I can just pass on a little bit of what I've learned and give a little bit to others, I'm sure, you know, everyone would be a lot happier as well. So, you know, I feel really greatly empowered as a result of studying these experiences. So, you know, if there's anyone out there wondering what life is all about, have a read about near-death experiences. Go and meet someone who's had an experience. Have a chat with them, you know, because I think the underlying message of the near-death experience is it's the golden rule, really, which is treat others as you would wish to be treated yourself. And that's at the heart of all of the wisdom traditions. And I think if we all thought and acted in that way, our world would be very different as well. So I think my research has really taught me to appreciate all that we have, all that I have, and everything that we have in life.
And are you planning on doing a new book?
Yeah, I would love to do some more books. At the moment, my schedule is absolutely hectic because I work full time at the university now, and it leaves very little time for doing my research. So if I could find a way to combine my research with my job, you know, make my research into my job, that's one thing I would love to do. Because, yes, I certainly do want to publish more books. I've got a lot of data that I still want to draw from as well. And so, yeah, in future, I will be writing more books. And in fact, Kelly Walsh, my co-author of The Transformative Power of Near-Death Experiences, we've been planning a series of books as well. So that'll be something for the future.
Now, can you tell us where we can find your books and also where we can find your website?
Yes, my website is www.drpennysartori.com. And the books are available in all good bookshops, and they're available online as well, so from online sellers. So, yeah, just kind of look them up. And the transformative power of near-death experiences, Kelly and I have decided that when we decided to write the book, that all of the royalties from the book will go to a charity called the Love Care Share Foundation that Kelly has set up as well.
Well, thank you so much for coming on to the Past Lives podcast. It's been a really great conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So that was an interview with Dr. Penny Sartori. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening to this remastered episode.